The following lecture is part of the Book of Genesis lectures at the Jewish Center. This is the third on November 3rd, 1960.
No, we're not getting to second day that quickly. We still have to finish off, polish off the first day. The last time we met, we had finished the words Vayehi Erev Vayivoke Yom Echad. It was one day. And we said we wanted to discuss the question of what does day mean? I haven't got the key there anyway, so that's private office. Yes. The question of what a day means in the Torah. Now, you see, geology presents all of us with a problem. According to modern geology, the universe is millions and millions of years old. The Earth is a youngster, it's only several million years old, or several billion years old. And when once it gets into that figure, once it's more than 5,721, it really doesn't make much of a difference to us, does it? The problem essentially remains the same. Jewish tradition counts 5,721 years plus a month and about 10 or 12 days, and geology goes off into the millions of years as the age of the Earth. How do you square scientific fact with biblical dicta? Well, there are two approaches, basically. I don't want to go now into the whole realm of science and religion. It's something that's much more than this question of geology. This is really a trivial question when you'll come to think of it after a while. And it's much too broad a field to enter now. But basically, there should be two approaches. In sharpening the conflict, I said, between scientific fact and biblical dicta, biblical statement. So the first thing we should point out is that whatever science says about something that occurred in the past is not, strictly speaking, fact. It's conjecture. It's an extremely good guess. It's very, very likely. But fact in science, in scientific method, the word fact is restricted to that which can be proven by repetition, by experimental repetition. No one has yet experimentally created the Earth in 7 million years. So that all the historical branches of science, and you know that most sciences have historical branches. For instance, astronomy has cosmology, cosmogony, the creation of the world. Biology has the study of fossils, or paleontology. Every science almost has its study of anthropology, or rather geography has geology. The study of man today, sociology, has its anthropology. Every science studies its area as is, and then taking these facts and following the normal human inclination to look backwards and find out where it all came from, what happened once upon a time, tries to apply the methods of the present to the experience of the past. But since scientific method strictly requires that every statement should be verifiable by experiment, therefore nothing about the past is necessarily absolutely so. You cannot be dogmatic. You can be dogmatic about the fact that water is made of hydrogen and oxygen. But you cannot be dogmatic about the fact that a dinosaur had 36 teeth in his upper right hand of his mouth. That you can't. You can conjecture. You can only conjecture that the world began with a nebulous and that it was composed mostly of water and partially of gold and carbon and other such things. You can guess at it. But proof? Never. Until you can produce it, you can actually prove it. This is a point made not only as a sort of apology for the biblical point of view, it's a point made by a man who was no less a skeptic in these things than James Conant, who now was in education but achieved his great fame as a scientist, as a chemist. And in one of the last books he wrote as a scientist, he points out that people, laymen, have a tendency generally to allow themselves to be carried away by every latest newspaper headline in which some scientist has projected his imaginings and declared this to be an idea. Well, a scientist, strictly speaking, will say, this is what I believe. That by the time the reporter gets it, this is fact. By the time the layman repeats it, it's been proven. But we can't do that, strictly speaking, because many of these things which have supposedly been proven have just as quickly been disproven. One theory follows upon another theory in such rapid succession that if you wait long enough, you have a new theory. So that we can't really say that this is fact. The age of the earth is good, healthy conjecture. Fact, we can call it. Why do I make this distinction? Because as long as it's fact, no one need have feel that his religious faith is being shaken. So that's the first approach we ought to take. The second approach is that even if we would grant that what science says in geology is fact, we still haven't been crushed. Because we have to know, you see, the trouble with those who dabble in science and religion, most people, that is, now not the people who really are in the know, but most people who dabble in science and religion is that they know neither one. Especially youngsters who come to their first taste of it and dogmatically make declarations of absolute truth that, it's nonsense, you know. Science has proven. Whenever you see the word science has proven, you know what follows is mere assertion, nothing more. Well, that kind of attitude used to be popular at one time. It no longer is and no longer should, because science isn't that dogmatic and religion isn't that simple. Religion isn't really naive. What we have learned here, and we've seen to an extent, in the last three, how many we've had before? The last two lectures, that what the Torah says is not really to be taken altogether literally, that beyond it and underneath it, there's a great deal, there's a whole world, a whole pulsating world. And if you try to declare a conflict between science and religion on the basis of the literal reading of three or four verses, then you're way out in left field. You can't do it. Furthermore, when it comes to specifically the age of the earth, the Torah doesn't tell us the age of the earth. We work backwards to get the age of the earth. And if we work backwards and we assume that the Torah's story of the creation of man was 6 days, the creation of the universe was 6 days, and God rested on the seventh day, if we take that as a week and then begin the story of Adam and take the story of Adam as being confined to a certain space of time, then we get 5,721. This is done as a handy way of defining the age length in biblical history. But who says that the whole story of Adam and Eve took place literally in one day? The Agudah says it all took place in one day. That Adam was born as a 20-year-old man. That day his wife was created. That day the serpent tempted her and she provoked him. He submitted. That day the sin. That day they were chased out of the Garden of Eden. Well, this is Agudah. Agudah must never be taken literally because you defeat its purpose. It was meant to teach you something very profound. Perhaps this Agudah meant to teach us that the whole drama of man can be played out in a day, therefore every day should be important. I don't know what the real lesson is. But you can't take these things literally. This may have lasted 20 years. Or it may be something that's even more than just a literal truth about a specific individual. Certainly the first 6 days, you have to take very much care with those first 6 days, and I'll tell you why. I would say that even before the advent of the modern age, even before modern science strongly inclined to believe that the world was millions and millions of years old, Jewish tradition already had that tradition. We never had any firm dogmatic assertion that the first 6 days meant only 6 days. Proof. What is the proof that a day doesn't mean 24 hours in the Bible? In this part of the Bible. Well, what are we up to? We're still on the first day. What does the first day mean? Does it mean 24 hours? It can't. Why can't it mean? Why can't you restrict yourself to 24 hours? Of course, because 24 hours is defined as the time it takes the earth to rotate around the sun. There was no sun yet. All you had created during the first day is a light and darkness. During that first day that were created, light was created. During that first day, as the next step in creation, God separated light from darkness and gave light the function of daytime. Well, This can last 1 million years too. It can last 5 million years. Yom Echad, obviously, if it doesn't necessarily mean 24 hours, can mean 24 hours and 10 minutes, or it can mean 10 million years. What's the difference, actually? It means a period. When we say that we have our week consists of 6 days plus the seventh day we rest because God rested on the seventh day, it means it's equivalent. Or I'll give you another example. At one point in the prophet Yechezkel, he makes an equation. He says the number of days that you sinned, that number of years will you be in exile. Every year corresponds to a day. Similarly here, every day corresponds to several, to an epoch, to an era. It doesn't necessarily have to correspond to a day. In Tehillim, for instance, in the Psalms, David says, Elef shonim b'yenecha ki yom esmo. 1,000 years are in thy sight, but as yesterday when it is past. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean that you can say that 1 year means exactly 1,000, that 1 day means 1,000 years? No. It's a poetic expression. It means that for man, a day is 24 hours. But before man comes in the scene, or even when man is, insofar as God is concerned, his perspective encompasses infinity, eternity. Therefore, what to us may seem a very significant 20-year stretch of human history is God. To God, it's a flicker of a second, because for God, the beginning of creation and the end of time are all one quick stretch. So that when we say Yom Echad, well, we use the word Yom. Insofar as God is concerned, it's his time. It could have lasted any length of time. Besides that, we have, again, much preceding the modern era, very specific references in some of our literature to the fact that the world was quite ancient. For instance, the Agudas Shmuel, quoted in one of Rabbi Kasher's books, which is a much older work than the modern era, maintains that every single day of the 6 days of creation is a minimum of 1 to 2,000 years in our present time reckoning. Well, if he could say it's 1 or 2,000, I could say 3 or 4 million. There's nothing, I mean... In other words, once you're not bound by the literal contemporary definition of day, then you're back to the idea of a period.
But there are places in the Talmud where the day actually means a day as we know.
Of course, when? After man is created, because then man experiences a day. You see? But before man comes on the scene, it has no significance. Before the sun comes on the scene, it certainly doesn't. So it's only here that it means that you have the right to interpret it loosely, and you're right. Afterwards, it means specifically a day, literally speaking. Otherwise, you can get lost in making metaphors.
It's not yes, Maurice? An hour of lived if you measure according to the pre-creation.
Well, it would have lived, yeah, several trillion years, it's true. Very true. Once man comes on the scene, then you adopt this of the human standard. You adopt the normal standard, rather than adopting the metaphoric yardstick of being long eras. Furthermore, both the Medrash and Bereishis Rabbah and the Zohar, and you know how far back this goes. This goes back to either early Middle Ages or ancient antiquity, already maintain that between the first and second verses of the Torah, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth was Tohu and Vohu, yes? And then there began creation. Between those two verses, God had created many worlds and destroyed them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu bone olamos vahorsan. God creates worlds and destroys them. Now, this creation of worlds and destruction of worlds can last any length of time. And who says that it's impossible for any relics of those worlds to be found in our world? Furthermore, if we accept this idea that there was creation, that the creation the Torah speaks of is our world, but that there were other creations before that. If we accept that, then what does 5,000, I remember now, what does 5,721 mean? Then it means only that is only the age of the present human civilization. Human history in our civilization goes back 5,720 years. But there's a prehistory, and that prehistory we don't know about. If you read the Chumash carefully, history just begins to break out slowly. Man and Adam and Eve and the serpent, this is a prehistory. This is not the beginning of history as we know it. As you go further, you have a flood. Incidentally, the flood probably occurred. It probably was the melting of the glaciers. And if you want proof of that, outside of the Chumash, almost every single people, every single ancient people has a flood legend. But where do they get it from? If not for the fact that someplace in the dim recesses of human history there was a flood, and it inscribed itself on the racial consciousness of all peoples. That's why we all have flood stories. Otherwise, why don't we have stories of earthquakes that should be common to all humanity? We don't. We do have flood stories. And the idea of the waters receding and ice and earth beginning to show, you have it before.
Is that before you glacial?
The melting?
The glacial.
No, if you follow Chumash, what you have, yes, you have the glacial period before this human life. But look, you have your very good question, but if you follow here, you see this. That in the beginning, earth begins to be seen. In other words, the glaciers recede. Then you have the beginning of vegetation, the beginning of life. But there still can be great movement of great glaciers, which as they melt, begin to destroy. If you assume, as we do, that almost all human history begins in the Mesopotamian area, in the Near East, then one severe glacier coming down and melting brings destruction pretty far. And therefore, from there, you have a spreading of civilizations and populations. Each one retains the memory of a great flood. After Noah, no, before Noah, you have a Torah that gives you hints. It doesn't go into it because that is not the interest of the Torah. A hint to the beginning of music, the beginning of technology, the beginning of tools. So you see, history just begins to unfold here. But it's our history. Now, you know what Einstein once said? That the last Second World War was fought with bombs, the Third World War with nuclear bombs, and the Fourth World War with bow and arrow. Well, there's a point there. Once a civilization destroys itself, the next one starts from scratch. There may very well have been very advanced civilizations that destroy themselves until our current civilization, where the sub-civilizations came into being. And there's no reason to... you say, why doesn't the Torah mention it? Because the Torah doesn't mention anything unless there's a purpose for it. So the Torah would have mentioned that there were prior civilizations. What would have made a difference to me? The Torah speaks only of that which is important to the people whom it addresses, which means us. And so far as we are concerned, there is something to learn in every word and every letter of the Torah. But if there's nothing to learn, the Torah doesn't mention it. There was no need to know this kind of knowledge. So that the problem of geology versus religion is not really a problem. Later on, we'll even discover that the problem of evolution versus creation is not really a problem, despite what Hollywood has done to it now on the channel.
Jumping ahead, what about the Ben-Gurion problem? Moses.
You know, that's ask me in 3 years since we study Shmos. By that time, Ben-Gurion will have some new theories we can discuss. Well, mazel tov, everyone. We finished the first day. At this rate, we should reach Abraham in about 4 or 5 years.
Could certainly take thousands of years to create. It takes us 3 weeks.
To learn. Very true. Well, now we're going to do a little skipping because we've gone through this, and I want to get on to the beginnings of human history with just a few remarks here or there. Let's get on to the beginning of life. Verse 11. That's chapter 1, verse 11. Vayomer Elokim, and God said, Tadshei ha'aretz desha esev mazriya zera, let the earth, how does he say it? Let the earth bring forth grass, herbs, yielding seed, fruit trees yielding fruit, lamineu, or lamino here, after its own kind. As you go on, you see that every creation dealing with vegetable or animal life constantly speaks of lamino, after its own kind, in its own form. The creation, in other words, is something that continues in its own species. That once an apple tree is created and it has apples, the apple seeds are not going to give an orange tree, but only an apple tree. Now, why this significance of lamino? Why does the Torah constantly speak of lamino? Yes. Well, Torah could have said that would be laminehem. But lamino means it's a preservation of a species. Yes. Correct. To show an orderliness, and one step further. To preserve that Maaseh Breishis throughout existence. that once God has created, then that creation, if it's lamino, if it consists, it continues, that means the apple tree that we have is a creation of God. Whether God evolved from a small apple tree to a big apple tree, from crab apples to Macintosh, doesn't make any difference. But the apple tree that God created is the apple tree that we have today. That means that when we see, when we contemplate the natural universe, that we are looking at God's creations. Of course, we know this apple tree came from another tree in a natural way. But when we contemplate that this is lamino, that this is after its kind, that was a creation by God, then we can appreciate from contemplating nature the existence of God and God's creativity.
Does that include the change evolution of
We'll come to that later. I don't want to talk about evolution until we come to man. After man is created, we can discuss evolution. Because otherwise, we have to discuss evolution evolutionarily. And I would rather discuss it all at once. Another interesting thing. Very often in the Torah, you find that biblical history, or rather biblical commandments, biblical instructions, make reference, not explicitly, but implicitly, to the creation of the world. For instance, or the early history of the world, for instance, there are certain parts of the animal we're not supposed to eat. The gid hanasha, what do you call it in English again? What's that? The gid hanasha. No, not sirloin steaks. The Torah doesn't talk about sirloin steaks that openly.
No, but it's in your vein.
Pardon? No. There's a certain vein. Excuse my lack of knowledge of English. Does anyone know what the gid hanasha is? Here it is. The sinew, the shank, the sinew is shrank. Well, it doesn't give any. It's not the same one. It's part of the gid hanasha. I'll think of it. You see, in studying, we never make reference to it in English. At any rate, the reason we don't eat it is because of Jacob's wrestling with the angel. So later on, recapitulates what happened earlier. The law has a genesis in Genesis, actually. But there's also a reversal. Remember I told you last time that one thing the rabbis say, when God called the light day, and he called the night, the darkness night, doesn't mean he gave it names, he began a vocabulary, but it means he gave to day the functions, he gave to light the functions of day, which means the mitzvahs that man is required to perform by day, the good deeds he's required to perform by day. And obviously, he gave to night, to darkness, the functions of nighttime, ethically speaking, morally speaking. So that in the creation, not only that later on, the moral order reflects the natural order, creation, but the natural order itself is based upon a moral order. That's why the rabbis say that the Torah was created, 576 generations before the creation of the world. What does it mean? Does it mean that before, how can you have generations before the creation of the world? Of course, again, a gadda must be taken in its deeper sense. It means that the moral order of the world precedes the natural order. Or similarly, the rabbis say that God, how did God create the world? So the rabbis say, just as an architect looks at his blueprint and from these plans creates the building, so God looked into the Torah and created the world. It means the natural order of the world reflects the moral order, reflects God's holiness, reflects the moral order that man is going to see in it. Similarly, many things are told to us in Bereishis primarily in order to explain to us why later we have certain moral injunctions. Now, do we have anything in the Torah that speaks of preserving species? Or of keeping species separate?
Yes. You're not allowed to mix
All right, let's before shatnas, let's go, let me know. Fruit and trees. Trees, you're right, this is the next step. For instance, you cannot cross certain kinds of trees. You cannot cross certain kinds of products of the vine, Clycarum and Clyzera. We'll come to it in a moment. This is it, this is the reason. That Torah doesn't say so, but you'll see in a minute. You cannot cross wool and pishtan, linen. In other words, you cannot wear a garment which is combined of wool and linen. What other kinds of prohibitions do we have in... So far it's seeds and clothing. What else?
An ox and
a donkey cannot plow, cannot be made into a team together, kept separate. What else?
And involve higher and higher until it reaches higher.
Before you involve higher, how about fleishik samuchiks? There are many places in the Torah that we keep things separate. And this keeping species separate, not mixing them, is a hark back to the fact that God created the world l'minehu, each species independent. When we mix the species, then we are doing what? Then we are, as it were, violating the Seder Maaseh Breishis. We are showing that we want to impose our will upon God's will in the universe. And that we can't do. God gave us plenty of place to work in the universe. But there are certain things we can't do. There are certain limits. You can take wool, you can make acetate fiber, and you can make rayons. You can mix wool and cotton. You can mix linen with silk. But there are certain things you can't do. God chose certain things to keep us on guard, to remind us at all times that you have to remember that the world was created l'minehu. Therefore, you know that the world was created. If you know that the world was created, you know there's a God in the world. Now, just for a second, to show you the contemporary importance of the concept behind milk and meat, behind shatnas, behind klayim, behind shor v'chamor, the plowing of an ox and a donkey. The principle behind it is that when God created a species, it should be preserved. What is the great problem with testing of atom bombs, with nuclear fallout, besides leukemia? Yes. The violation of the human being's genetic integrity. That we're going to create mutations. In other words, we're going to change Lamino. Man was created Lamineu. Man was created in one form. We're going to change that. Till now we may have thought that it's a taboo, you know? This is a Jewish taboo. But now we see that the Jewish taboo is based upon an idea which, if we're not going to accept it, will destroy the human race. Or at least breed monsters. So that the concept of Lamino should therefore motivate Jews to be very conscious of the problem of fallout and the genetic integrity of human beings. No, we can talk about evolution a little later, perhaps. Just to give you one word. Yes, but just to give you one idea. Evolution isn't that simple. Again, this is dogma. I'm prepared to personally accept a great deal of what biologists tell us about evolution in the past, but certainly not everything. And my own prejudice was confirmed 3 years ago when I read an article by Jean-Paul Aron, who was the greatest biologist in France and the winner of the Nobel Prize in Biology, who pointed out that there are so many loopholes in all evolutionary theories that he doesn't know what's going on. If he doesn't, then even the people who are making the Hollywood picture don't. Now, he points out that there are 17 distinct species, and that so far in all the history of our discoveries in paleontology, we have discovered no intermediate steps other than these original 17. He seems to feel that in the species of the human, in the animal world, there is a lamino, or laminehu, that you can have evolution within the species, but you do not have any crossbreeding. Now, I'm not a biologist, but I'm just telling you the article that I read. Well, call them both an elephant. What? An elephant by any other hide weighs as much. Smaller or bigger. Or you have certain changes in features. I mean, we see, if you want to call that evolution, we see it in our own times. I'm sure that when I look back to my parents and then to my grandparents, I didn't know their grandparents, people were small. Nowadays, it seems, especially as I look ahead of me, children grow taller than their parents generally in America. Development is different. No, I'm just trying to show there is change in the human form, I grant you. More children today are born with a lighter complexion, perhaps, huh?
One finger less or one finger more contradictory to the mino.
No. Lamino doesn't mean... It's like saying, what is a man? Is a man hands and feet and eyes? What happens if he has no hands, feet, and eyes? He's not a man. There's a sense of totality. A species is defined by a series of qualities or attributes, but it doesn't mean that every single one of them is important. I mean, it's the aggregate that really spells out. I mean, this is the problem of totality. You know, Lucretius's old question, you see a flock of sheep.
Within the species.
Yes. Within the species, there can be. Let me finish this first. We'll come to change in a minute. Pardon? Incidentally, if you want to see evolution, you see it in this. You see it right here. Did you notice how the order, did I mention this before? How the order of the 6 days creation goes from simple to more complex, from inorganic to from energy to inorganic matter, especially water, to the beginnings of organic life, especially beginning from the sea. Then you have animal life, then you have human life. Well, this is the evolutionary order. And if you take what I said before about this being a long expanse of time, we're not so far off. Now, you can't catch me on details because of two reasons. First, the Torah wasn't interested in giving us evolutionary details. Second, no one evolutionary theory has yet gained victory in the three or four major ones that are still battling for supremacy. I mean, Lamarckian theory may still be on the up and up in Russia, whereas Darwinism may be, or neo-Darwinism may be important here.
The Lord certainly, we know, he already had created.
He had created species. But I'll come to you in a minute. I want to show you that he created certain things that became extinct. And if you want to see that, hold on for a moment. Turn to the creation of the sea monsters.
21.
Yep, you found it. Verse 21. Vayivra Elokim es hataninim hagdolim. And God created... What was the verse before that? It's the beginning of the fifth day now, isn't it? Beginning of the fifth day, and God said that the waters bring forth abundantly moving creatures that have life. Beginning of marine life. Then fowl that may fly above the earth, the open expansion of the heaven. Notice that it seems that flying things are closely related to the sea too. Just as a derech agav, a Lamarckian evolutionary note in the Talmud, that the reason birds have webbed fingers, have scales on their fingers, is because they came originally from fish.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so he creates everything in its totality.
No.
That's what I understand. That's how I understood your interpretation.
Yeah, wherever you have the word lumino. Mm-hmm. Wherever you have the word lumino.
Well,
and the creation here is
everything,
no.
Everything.
Listen to this. The creation here is of fish or marine life, luminehu, in a species. Then he creates birds. Now, there's nothing to say that he doesn't create the birds from several species of fish.
Well, that is not luminehu.
Yes, it is. I'll give you an example. There are 10 species of fish created. An example. Probably thousands upon thousands. There are 10 species of fish that are created. Two of them evolve into birds, into 10 species of birds. The other 8 remain lumino and continue their development along in their species. Now, you may not recognize today's tuna fish from a million years ago. Frankly, you don't recognize today's tuna fish in the can from what you see in the street, too. But you may not recognize it, but it's in the same species. It has evolved within the same form. I'll give you an example. When you were a small boy, I had a pet, a little dog. That dog grew up and you grew up. You're not the same person that you were when you were 1 year old.
I understood how it was interpreted.
Yeah, and that's, this is my conjecture. I mean, don't say that this is Torah. I am trying now to do what every Jew has done throughout the ages, to try to understand the Torah in the light of his own knowledge. Now, very possibly, 100 years from today, there'll be completely new knowledge, and the theories that we bandy about today about evolution may be just the part of the kind of things that some rusty old scientist or historian studies as what people thought about when they were very naive. And they'll have other theories they want to read into Torah. I don't know. Right now, our duty is, where are we up to in human knowledge? The human knowledge that we have, the secular knowledge, that is for us to work with. As long as we don't take it as being divine and final. Then we try to read it into the Torah to understand the Torah in the light of modern knowledge. I'm opposed to those who refuse to do so. Or those who regard this as a sin. But I can't take that completely rightist attitude that you're not allowed to relate one form of knowledge to another. I believe in relating the knowledge, but with the understanding that science is always changing, and that you cannot therefore take the Torah and finally gear it or connect it to an evolving form of knowledge. You know, did I ever tell you the story of the soldier who was sick in the army, the GI who was sick, and he came to the army doctor and complained that he can't fall asleep at night? You know how army doctors are. They always suspect a poor soldier of hypochondria, and they're generally right. So he said, well, if you can't sleep at night, he didn't even examine him, he said, then eat a heavy meal before you go to sleep and you'll be able to sleep. 2 weeks later, the young man is back and said, you know, doc, he said, I can't sleep at night. He said, well, all you have to do is make sure you don't eat anything after lunch. He said, but just 2 weeks ago, you told me to eat a heavy meal before I go to sleep. He said, son, you have no idea how much modern science has progressed in the last 2 weeks. We have a progressing form of knowledge. We can't hold it tight, but we certainly can interpret in the light of that knowledge. Now, look at that verse 21. Vayivra Elohim esataninim hagdolim, and God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind. Well, what kind of sea monsters do we have here? Probably whales and other kinds of unusually large probably mammals. I would probably assume that they're mammals because they're so unusually large. What's unusual? Huh?
And that's specifically the leviathan.
Coming to it in a minute.
Whales?
Whales are mammals, certainly. Let me ask, what is unusual about the mention of Taninim? Anything unusual here? Why would you wonder why the Torah mentions it? Yes, Joe?
Animals, fish, for instance. You know, this is sort of a combination of...
No. Let's keep them in the fish class and forget that they're mammals. I mean, from that point of view, there's nothing fishy about this. But let me ask you, why doesn't the Torah mention what is that name, that precursor of the elephant? The
Mastodon.
Why doesn't the Torah mention the dinosaurs? Or rather, not dinosaurs. Why doesn't the Torah mention elephants? It's a very big animal. It's bigger than a cat.
Maybe it's still around today.
All right, well, why doesn't the Torah mention the true? Well, you answered the question, basically. But no, yes, you did answer the question. You see what the... yes. And this is the point I'm aiming at. Yes and no. I'll tell you why yes and no.
You really defined it.
When the Torah mentions Taninim, if you remember the first time, the Torah has in mind two classes of people it's speaking to. One is the people who received the Torah at that time and who lived in a particular cultural context. And two is all generations thereafter. Now, in this Taninim, the people who first received the Torah knew exactly what the Torah is aiming at. Do you know why? Because the creation myths that abounded in Egypt and in Canaan told the story of creation whereby the great sea monsters rebelled against the God who created them, and they took over the world. And they were supposed to represent the God of evil, as opposed to the God of creation, who was the God of good. This was the ordinary myth. The Torah never mentions the opposition by name. It's not running as open an election campaign as we have now. The Torah does things by indirection, implicitly. So the Torah, knowing that there are such theories that speak of the Taninim, the Canaanite myth of the Baal fighting versus the other gods, and the fish, the sea monster rather, coming up against it. So it tells you something. What does it tell you? It tells you as an exception. The first place in the Torah where the Torah mentions a specific part of the species. It doesn't mention the red oakwood red trees, redwood oaks. It doesn't mention the great elephants or a ferocious lion. They're not important. This is the only place the Torah comes to a particular. And says of all the fish, the Torah mentions the Taninim. Because the Taninim in the myths that were current at that time were those who rebelled against God and who were independent of God, actually, who were able to rebel against Him. So the Torah tells you nonsense. Vayivra Elokim es hatalinim hagdolim. God created them. There's nothing special. They may be big, but they're no different from other fish. God created them. There is no part of creation that can possibly set himself up as an independent force against the Ribbono Shel Olam. Furthermore, look at the end of verse 21. Vayara Elokim, what did God see? Ki Tohu was good. No rebel, no revolution, no special story. They are natural creatures the same as every other natural creature. So that there's nothing unusual about them. Later on, you find in Tanakh that Isaiah will mention the Leviathan, one of the sea monsters, as a symbol for evil. There he knows that in the folk mind, the Taninim are used as rebels against God. He only uses it poetically. Since it's already said that the word itself means evil, so he uses it as a poetic sign for evil. But the Leviathan as such, which means the sea monster or the whale, is a natural creature which God created, Vayara Elokim Ki Tov, and it's good. But now getting back here, there's an interesting point that the Ramban raises. Very interesting. If you look at the other things, the creation of... let's take the top of that page. The last word on the first line, page 2. Vayehi chen, and it was so. God said, let there be such and such, and it was so. Here, at this particular point, or let's say take verse 24. Vayomer lekin, and God said, let the earth bring forth the living things, living creatures. And what's the end of that sentence, verse 24? Vayehi chen, it was so. After the taninim, after the sea monsters, you don't find it. Why? So Ramban says there are many creatures that God created that became extinct. And where they became extinct, the Torah doesn't say, it was so. Because it was so means it lasted. It had a kiyum. It kept on going all the way through. So that the word, and this refers, according to him, to the Talmudic legend, the Agoda, that there were two sea monsters, Leviathan and his mate, the female mate of Leviathan, that the female mate was killed and preserved for the great future. Well, if it was killed, it means it did not survive. Little Leviathans didn't come on the scene. So here, again, it refers to what we would today call certain species becoming extinct. In this case, the Torah doesn't use the word vayihichen, and that's why the Torah doesn't tell you about dinosaurs or other such things which became extinct.
How about those
Yeah, that's a very special, the question of what it means there is a problem. But to have ordinarily to have a race of giant men, of strong men, is nothing unusual.
There's an African tribe, the Watusi.
The Watusi is 7 feet tall.
7 feet tall.
Maybe they're the animal.
No, I mean, but, yes, but I would say that since you see that we can have a race of giants, then there may have been a race of giants, then there's nothing unusual about it. Sometimes giants develop, sometimes they just dwarf.
They're
extinct, yeah.
Why was it mentioned in the 18th sentence that it was good when it was in relationship to day and night?
Oh, there is what we discussed last time. The word, the whole idea of there is good is repeated every single day except for one day. At the completion of every new step in the creation, we have the words, it was good, which means it didn't happen of its own accord, but it was a result of divine act. He told me the world is good.
Then why after the creation of man,
oh yes, after the creation of man, you have Kito. Of course, you have it on the top of page 3, verse 31. Yes, everything was good. It was very good. Yes. So you see, it was very good. Now what the word very means there, we'll see later on, is very interesting. Some of the comments the rabbis had, which are very difficult to understand, but there obviously is something there. Now, before we go on with the Taninim, what did God do to the fish and the fowl? In verse 22, God blessed them, by Yavarach Hashem Elohim, God blessed them, saying, Pru urvu umilu ha'aretz, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let the fowl multiply on the earth.
And you didn't do
what kind of blessing? Well, forget about the sea monsters.
No, I mean,
you know, no, obviously not. No. But fish otherwise and fowl did multiply. They got a blessing from, what does it mean to bless? Almost every place, according to Ramban, that you find in this area of the Torah, the word blessing, and generally when you use the word blessing, it means to be fruitful and to multiply. With all due apologies to Malthus, in the Torah, bracha refers to increase. It refers to increasing. You have the blessing to Abraham. God gave Abraham a blessing. What was the blessing? Isaac, children, nations coming from you. The blessing to man, later on, pruur revu, to increase. And even in a world that's overpopulated, still, pruur revu is regarded as a bracha. Your problem? We're not going to discuss problems now, but there are solutions. I mean, there is such a thing as conquering the earth, there is such a thing as providing for people. There are certain things beyond our ken. Whatever it is in the Torah, wherever it says bracha, it refers to pru or devor. It has some connotation of increase or multiplication. Now we go on to the most important of all, the story of the sixth day. What has created the first two, when the first two verses of the sixth day, what has created? What is that? Verse 24 and 25. Animal life, yes? Land animals. And then let's read from verse 26 and on. Beth, do you want to take that? And God said,
let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Man shall have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the heaven, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth.
All right. And God created man.
In his image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them.
And God blessed them, and so on and so forth. Remarkable, isn't it? God created man in his image. What does the word image normally mean?
Shape,
form. Does that mean that God has a shape of a form like a giant man with hands and feet and a head? Could it ever have meant that? No. Could never have meant that. I'll tell you why. Could you imagine Moses, who says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, who teaches the whole belief in God to his people, to write these words and to mean it literally, that God has a shape and created, he gave that same shape to man? It's unthinkable. Absolutely unthinkable. Besides, as Maimonides points out, the word selam and demus do not mean shape or form or image in the physical sense or geometric sense. Because for that you have the Hebrew word toar, such as Yefas Toar, Yefas Mara, beautiful of shape and beautiful of appearance. You have the word Toar or Tsura, Tsura, which means a picture. If it had meant to say that God created man in his picture, it would have said Betsura, so Vataro. Selam and Demus means something much different. What it means, we'll see if in a few moments the various interpretations given to it, but here we come to one of the most important comments or insights about human nature and about the value of human life. The idea of Tselem and Demus, of creating in God's image and God's form, generally speaking, should be called spirituality. Just the contrary. That God gave man the element of Ruchnius, the element of spirituality. And that this element of spirituality is what differentiates man from other creatures and what makes him alike unto God. You see, because the problem here is that God creates all animals. Well, man is an animal too. Man is a natural being, isn't he? He's created, he follows after the dogs and the cats. He must be a natural being. At the same time, he was created in the image of God, which other animals were not. So whatever you interpret image as must have two points of reference. It must be similar to God, and it must be dissimilar to animal. We're looking for that which is distinctive in human nature. That which is distinctively human, especially human. Now, what is the interpretation of Tselem? Actually, the interpretation of Tselem tells you what your whole philosophy of life is. Ooh, the philosophy of man, which is even more significant, perhaps. In Jewish life, you've had three schools. Each one has given its own particular interpretation to the word Tselem. First, you had the philosophic school. And the first one to work on the concept of Tzelem as the basis of his philosophy was Saadia, which means the 9th century, end of the 9th century, beginning of the 10th century, 1,000 years ago. Then it was picked up, of course, by who was the great rationalist, greatest philosopher of Judaism in that age? Maimonides, 300 years later. These two developed the idea of Tzelem as meaning what? What is the image of God referred to?
Spirit.
Well, spirit in a general sense, but they define it much more clearly.
Intellect.
Intellect, reason, seichel. That which differentiates man from animal and which makes man akin to God is his intellect. And therefore, the highest value in all human life is placed on what? On reason. Reason is the highest value. That's why they're called rationalists. Because they believe that reason is the greatest thing, the greatest part of the human, of the whole human scene. That reason is that which is immortal. Reason is the only thing that differentiates man and that gives man his superiority over animals. And man is godly because he has reason, because he has an intellect. Maimonides pointed out that the word Tzelem should be interpreted as Tzura Tiv'is, the natural form. By that he means that in everything, in every object, you can distinguish the incidental qualities from the essence. For instance, this is a Gemara, copy of the Talmud. What would you say is this book? Well, you could say it contains 88 pages. It's a foot and a half long by a foot wide, half an inch thick, and it's red. Does this describe a Gemara? These are the incidental qualities of this Gemara. The essence of it is the whole spirit of the Talmud, the whole spirit of Jewish law. Similarly, you take a watch. You could say, what is the watch? You say the watch has a black band, it has 12 numbers, it has two hands. Yes, but the essence of the watch is keeping time. That is what makes it distinctive. In everything, you can distinguish the essential from the, we're calling it incidental. In their language, philosophically, it's called accidental. Because if you take that watch and paint it red instead of gold, it still is a watch. If you take it and make it, instead of 12 numbers, you make no numbers, it still is a watch. You can sort of feel where it's going, where the numbers are. So therefore, you have, in every object, you have essence and you have the accidents. So if you take man, what are his incidental qualities? Eyes, ears, feet, shape, color, texture. What is the essence of man? Mind. Tzelem refers to the essence of man, not to the incidental shape or the accidental attributes. What makes man distinctive, different from every other form of creation, is his intellect. And therefore, when, according to them, when we say that man was created in the image of God, that means he was born with a mind, because God is pure mind.
I was thinking, you said that the essence of a watch is that it keeps time. What if a watch is broken and no longer serves its purpose? So is it a watch?
It's a watch only because of its accidental, it's lost its essence. What do you do with a watch that's lost, that's broken? Do you wear it? If you wear it, then it proves that the watch that you've worn to begin with was not essentially for timekeeping, but for a decorative show, for cosmetic reasons. You see? Very, very much so. If you only broke a small part and it still keeps time, you still keep on wearing it, unless you give it to repair for preventive reasons. But the essence is what makes it different and distinctive. So that, similarly, with man, the Tzelem of man, the essence, rather than the accidental qualities, is the intellect, and that is the Tzura HaTevit, the natural form, according to the Rambam. This is the whole rationalist tradition within Judaism, and we had a very powerful rationalist tradition, which spoke very strongly of reason and knowledge and intellect as the highest values in life. But there's also another tradition, not a philosophic tradition, but an ethical tradition. Not the school of philosophy, but the school of Musar. And here, the expression of this school, the climax of the school, also is represented by Tzelem. And Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, an Italian scholar, Italian Jewish scholar, in his Mesilas Yesharim, speaks about Tzelem. Do you know what he said Tzelem is? Not reason, not seichel, but ratzon, will, free will of man. Why? Why not reason? Because I may have reason and still it may not be decisive in my life. I may know that reason tells me that it's not right to travel at 60 miles an hour down Columbus Avenue near 86th Street. But who says I'm going to do it? I may will to drive at 70 miles an hour. And I may do this even whilst knowing that it's wrong. Many people do things even though they're aware of the fact that it's not reasonable. So that I may often follow reason, I may often not follow reason. Reason, therefore, is not autonomous. It doesn't prevail. It's not absolute. What does prevail? My free decision, my will. I can will to follow the path of reason. I can will to follow the path of my desires, my instincts, my baser inclinations. Therefore, what is decisive in the human personality? The mind? No. What then? The free will of a man. This free will is the godly element within him. God is free, and he gave me part of that freedom. Of course, seichel is important. Why is seichel important in freedom? Why do I say that Lotzato, while saying that the Tzelem, the image of God, is in his will, cannot abandon reason completely? Why not? Well, does an animal have free will? You're on the right track. Does an animal have free will? Well, let me ask something else. Do I have the free will? Do I really have the free will to decide as between Einstein's equation and Planck's quantum theory? Well, I have the free will, of course. I can get up on the rooftop and or one of these campaign trucks and I shout, Einstein was right and Planck was wrong. No one's going to arrest me. Does it mean that I've made a free will decision? Of course not, because I don't know what I'm talking about. Or it's like Jewish parents saying, well, I don't want to send my child to a yeshiva or to a Talmud Torah. I want him to make up his own mind. Make up his own mind. He's not making up his own mind. You're making up his mind for him. Because why? Because freedom can only be real if it's based upon knowledge. If I know my alternatives, I can make a choice. I have freedom. If I don't know the alternatives, I'm not making any choice. I'm going by chance. It's whim. I'm being whimsical. The only time that I can really choose is if I know the alternatives. I weigh them. My free will, that core, that vital core in man, that is uninfluenced, he can make a decision. But if I don't know, I can't decide. Therefore, you're right. An animal hasn't got reason. Therefore, his choice is not a free choice. It's blind will, not free will. When man has knowledge, he makes a free choice. Pardon?
Instinctive.
It's instinctive, of course. It's only an instinct. It's not really a decision of his free will. Therefore, you have to have reason, but reason isn't enough. You have to have free will with reason. But ultimately, it's the will that counts. Reason is only a tool which gives will the ability to decide intelligently. So that in the ethical tradition, therefore, freedom rather than reason is the image of God. There is one more, and I say the word freedom, I don't mean freedom in a political sense. I mean freedom in the intensely personal sense, in the psycho-philosophical sense, if you want, but upon this depends freedom in the larger sense. If we don't believe that man is free to choose, let's say, between good and evil, then you can't very well convince me that it's good for man to be free politically. Because if man is a slave to begin with, why shouldn't he be a slave politically? In this sense, politics, ultimately depends upon your view of man as such.
Well, isn't that philosophy of thinking beshert a very dangerous type of...
Precisely. The word beshert is rather un-Jewish.
And yet, people who consider themselves very pious, that's part of their real feeling of life.
Yes and no. I'll tell you why. After all, I mean, we speak about freedom. Freedom is a tremendous topic. The problem of what do we do, what are we forced to do? Let's say, you can say, well, if I were born under different circumstances, I might have different beliefs, better or worse. So then I'm not free. But yet we know that basically we are free. This question of freedom versus determinism, as we call it, because our actions are determined before, is a very, very difficult topic. It's a topic that every philosopher who has ever written about anything has had to deal with. To give you only a small clue of the importance, when I teach my class at Yeshiva in Jewish philosophy, I spend about one-third of the term on this one topic. And then I barely can begin to scratch the surface because it's so vast. But to put it in a nutshell, I would say this, that the Jewish view is neither extreme. Man is not completely free. He's not. That's why education counts for so much. Because you can determine, you can shape habits. That's why it's important to choose the right friends. Because once, by a free will decision, you decide to go with bad friends, your free will is diminished after that. Because you become a slave to that society. If you make a free will decision to go with good friends, you've increased your area of freedom. So that man is not completely free. What he is not completely free, in Kol Basheret. That's why I said rather un-Jewish, not completely un-Jewish. There's an area where we are not free. On the other hand, we are absolutely, positively, and without reservation, unqualifiedly opposed to those schools which say that all about man is determined beforehand, that he's completely unfree. We maintain he is absolutely free. There is a core of freedom in every individual. If you say Basheret, then you mean that everything that's going to happen to him is determined, it's un-Jewish. If you say many things, yes. But his basic ability to choose between right and wrong, that remains his, and God can't take it away from him. That belongs to man and man alone. Finally, the third big school, and I'm giving you the outline of the three schools before I go to an analysis of the individual verse, because this verse, as I mentioned to you, is really, it's powerful. It has a great deal of meaning. The third school is the Kabbalistic. The first we said is the philosophical, then the ethical, now the Kabbalistic. The Kabbalistic school has had many variations on the theme. The one I want to give you is, it so happens, not by a Hasidic heir to Kabbalah, but by a Lithuanian, one of the greatest anti-Hasidim or Misnagdim. That's Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin in his Nefesh HaChaim. He points out that the greatness of God is that God controls and creates entire worlds. And the image of God in which man was created was the ability that God gave to man to control or destroy, to control, which means to create or to destroy entire worlds. The ability to create or destroy, in one word, where Jewish philosophy speaks of Tzelem as reason, where Jewish ethics speaks of Tzelem as will, the Kabbalah, through Reb Chaim Volozhiner, speaks of Tzelem as creativity. Just as God is a borei, creating something from nothing, so must man be a yotzer, to create something new from something old. And this creativity of man can be expressed in two levels, in the spiritual and in the material universe. Shemayim and Aretz, in heaven and on earth. In both realms, man can express a creativity that is godly. And in both realms, the essence of creativity is to take tohu vavohu and bring order into it. To take chaos, as the world was chaotic when God created it, and pull it apart until you see order coming into things. How does man think? A creative thought. Not that something suddenly occurs to you out of the blue sky. That doesn't occur. You may think it occurs. Basically, in your mind, whether conscious or subconscious, there is a chaos of ideas, of bits of ideas, of jagged ends of ideas. The creative moment comes when suddenly you see a new order, a new perspective, where everything falls into line, you have a new idea. You take tohu vavohu, and you create laminehu. Everything falls into line, there's order that reigns out of the chaos. This is the creativity of man, and according to the Kabbalah, he gets his creativity from God. This is the Tzelem Elokim, the ability to create, and therefore the freedom to destroy too. Because either you create or you don't create. Either you exercise the image of God, or you deny the image of God. You rebel against it. But the image of God means man's creativity. So these two areas are the place that man can create. You know, the German philosopher Immanuel Kant once said that two things fill me with endless wonder: the starry heavens above me and the moral consciousness within me. I mean, you look up, especially in the country, in 86 feet, of course, there are no stars. But sometimes we get a chance, especially in a dense summer day, a dense summer night, to see the tremendous worlds. If you read about it, it's frightening too. Then you're led to the wonder about the universe. And then when you begin to think, not at how evil man is, but where did man get the penchant for good? Where did I get the feeling of embarrassment at doing evil? Shame. The feeling of shame is one of the most wonderful things that man has. To be able to feel ashamed of yourself when you've done wrong. It's a sign of a moral consciousness. This is equally wonderful. And therefore both these areas, nature, the starry heavens, and the moral order within, are areas of creativity. But of course, much before Kant, a man called David, who was much less sophisticated, a philosopher, but quite bigger as an individual, as a human being, wrote a capital tillum, a chapter of the Psalms, and he divided it into two. The first one began, you'll recall it, L'manatzeach Mizmor LeDavid, we say it on Shabbos. The first one began, Hashamayim Mesaprim Kvod Keil Maaseh Yadav Magdol Hakiya. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament tells of the creation of his hands. And then how does the second part of that chapter begin? Toras Hashem Tamima Meshivas Nafesh. The Torah of God is pure, is perfect. It restoreth the soul. The first one is the starry heavens. The second one is the moral consciousness. So that Kant was merely recapitulating a capital tillum. I think he would have turned over in his grave had he known it. And the idea, in pre-theological form, not in such sophisticated language, was already said by David, because these are the areas where man can create in the image of God, as God had enabled him to, as a creature of God, as a special creature of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So these are the three definitions of Tzelem in our tradition. And how you relate to each of these three depends on your personality, your background, and your whole intellectual bent as a Jew. Neither one of these is absolute. All of these, as I told you, can be summarized by the word spiritual. Does spiritual mean primarily intellectual? Primarily the will, and therefore a more religious tone perhaps, what we would call religious, or does it mean creativity in its full sense? But all of these are aspects of spirituality. All of these are Tzelem Elokim, the image of God. Well, shall we go on, or do you? Can I ask that? Well, if anyone wants to go, please, let's break it up now. Unless you want to go one more word. One more thing. And here I want to read to you a Rashi. Let me just raise a few problems. I'll raise the problems now and we'll come to it some other time. Otherwise, it's too far to... Let's take that verse 26. Vayomer Elokim, and God said, what did God say? Naase Adam b'tzalmeinu kedmuseinu. Take the first word, naase. What is naase in English?
Let us.
Let us make. Yes? What is difficult about that verse?
We.
Who's we? There's no one around yet. What's the second word? Naase Adam. What does the word Adam mean?
Mm-hmm.
Out of what? Yes, but what is the word Adam itself? Where does it come from? That's what everyone says. All right, that's number one. Well, we're not sure about it. Tentatively, it's probably so, but we're not sure about it. Then Bitzalmenu, in our image, as our form. Now, just quickly turn to verse 27. What did God create? And God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Why not they? Yes?
What is the difference between
Vayetzer
and Vayibro?
Yes, I said last week that Ramban and Hadak, not 2 weeks ago, when we began, Ramban and Hadak explained very carefully the difference between Borei and Yotzer. Borei is Yesh Me'ayim. Yotzer is Yesh Meyesh. Bore is the ex nihilo creation. You God creates something out of nothing. That's Bore. Bresh is Bara Elokim. Yotzer means to create something out of something else.
Because Guru is by Taninim and by Buddha.
Bura?
Bura.
By Taninim and by Buddha. Yeah. And yet, here there is a creation out of nothing, but not completely. Not completely. Especially with man, he is created partially. Well, what is man created of? Pardon? Where do you see that? Not here. Do you?
No.
Where then? Chapter 2, verse 7. Now, Mr. Kaplan, notice the first word there. Perek Beis, verse Zion. Vayitzer. Not Bara. And what does God create him of? Afar min Adama. Dust of the earth. Here the creation is something from something, therefore use the word Yotzer. Here, what does God create over here? God creates God, and how does he create man? In his image. So what is the Torah referring to primarily? To his body? No. But then to his spirit. His spirit is Yesh Me'ayim. Interesting? Man is compounded of two parts, as we'll have much occasion to discuss it as we go on. His body and his soul. Later on, when it speaks of his body, Afar min Adama, dust from the earth, he uses the word Vayitzer. There is Yesh Me'ayim. Man comes from organic material. Here, when he speaks about the creation of B'Tselem, in which he refers primarily to the spirit comes out of nothing. God creates it, and therefore uses the word Bara rather than Yatzar. So you see that the words are consistent so far. So that the question here is, why this repetition of B'Tselem, and why is it now in the singular? One more thing. Look at the end. Very last word of chapter 1. The very last words. Vayi erev, vayi voker. And it was night and it was morning. And what was it? Yom what? Yom HaShishi, the sixth day. What is so different about this expression? What's the problem? Well, so would every other day.
I know, but we gave the God gave light the name day.
Yes, but that was about no different. Why is it different from the second, third, fourth? Yes, what's that?
Yom Hashishi.
That's right. You have Yom Sheni, Shlishi, Revi, Chamishi, and here is Hashishi, the definite article. You have it was evening, it was morning, second day, third day. Here you have the sixth day, Yom Hashishi. What's the hay doing there? Why here do we have the sixth day? So these are some of the problems we want to discuss before we go in to Shabbos. Good Shabbos.